Welcome to episode 60. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. And starting with this week's industrial roundup and turning in particular to community health as it continues to make its way through a heavy year of bargaining. Currently, we have bargaining proposals out for consultation with members with respect to the health and allied services managers and administrative officers replacement agreement. We also have a detailed bargaining proposal out to members with respect to the medical scientists agreement. That's the agreement that covers dietitians, psychologists, audiologists and pharmacists. The objective of those proposals is to facilitate with members a position that we can take back to the relevant unions as part of the bargaining process. Also this week, we have further time on the 26th of April at the Fair Work Commission with VARPA with respect to allied health professionals as we continue interest-based bargaining for community health with the assistance of the Fair Work Commission. With respect to our health service members, on Monday we have an SDPPWG meeting with the MSAV with respect to medical scientists, and biomedical engineering bargaining continues on Tuesday. Thank you to all of you who have been watching these podcasts. In the month of March, for the first time, we had more than 1,000 downloads of this particular podcast. As always, all of our activities are summarised through the VHA community app, and that's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Take a letter, Maria. Address it to my wife. Say I won't be coming home. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. And joining me for this week's discussion is Workplace Relations Advisor Yunbin Lin. Welcome, Yunbin.
Thank you, Stuart.
Your very first time to the podcast.
It is.
Hopefully it's not the first time that you've experienced a podcast. I hope that you've seen some of the earlier editions.
Absolutely. Definitely had a watch of quite a few of them, actually.
Very good.
Yeah.
Would you be good enough to reveal the clue which is going to indicate the subject for our discussion today?
I've always wanted to do one of these.
So for the benefit of those people who are listening to this podcast rather than watching, could you describe the item?
Would appear to be pig's nose on a string, costume.
Indeed. And based on that clue, what would you say that the subject for our discussion today is?
Well, Halloween comes to mind. Roast pork of some kind.
So disappointingly, Halloween is not yet a public holiday and roast pork is not yet an enforceable term of our enterprise agreements, but we can always hope. What the snout represents, obviously, is a pig, and in particular, a special pig that is Wilbur. Wilbur from Charlotte's Web. Charlotte's Web was written by E.B. White. And one of the things we're going to be discussing today is this book, The Elements of Style. The White, who, in terms of the authorship of this book, is E.B. White, the author of Charlotte's Web and Stuart Little, among other things. And we're going to be talking about this book, and it brings us to today's subject, which is writing letters. So writing letters is a challenge for those people who work within people and culture. And the challenge is how to respond to difficult letters that they might receive from employee representatives. Writing a letter in response is not simply a task. It's a definite skill that people can develop. When it's done well, it can assist in terms of managing workplace issues. If it's done badly, it will exacerbate that workplace issue. Mm-hmm. So first things first, in order to talk about writing a letter of response, first of all, we need a letter to respond to. So up on screen is a letter that's been written for the express purpose of today's podcast, and it's been designed to reflect specific elements that frequently appear in letters to VHA members. However, the letter does not reflect any particular letter from a particular union, and just to ensure that there's no confusion on that point, all the names in this letter that now appear on screen have been taken directly from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, Oklahoma. So here's our letter from the Federated Union of Workers. When we receive a letter from a union, the first thing we should do is assess it. What kind of letter is it? Is it engaging? Is the person sending it seeking truth, knowledge, and cooperation, or is it a stinker?
All right. So why do we need to determine what kind of letter it is, Stuart?
Because we shouldn't respond to letters as though they're all the same. It's too easy to answer letters on automatic pilot, but it's far better to engage with the content and shape an answer accordingly.
Right. So then I suppose, what are the telltale signs of a stinker or a badly written letter, as it were?
Some of the signs are obvious. So if we just get that letter back up on screen and we start from the outset, the first thing you'll notice is the way that letter begins.
So you mean, dear sir, madam, other?
That's right. As a general rule, the more formal the mode of address, the more hostile the content is likely to be.
So what other signs should I be looking for?
So let's move to the second paragraph. So the second paragraph talks about, it's come to my attention that in January, March and April of this year that employees were required to work overtime without being paid for it. When workers asked whether they should include this time on their timesheets, management said this would be extremely detrimental to their career prospects. So what we have is an allegation of widespread breach of the agreement without the provision of particulars that would assist to address those concerns.
So there's an allegation of a breach, but we don't have a date. There's no specific area. There's no specific manager. I mean,
That's right. Mm. If we move on to the next paragraph that's up on screen, it makes an allegation of bullying without details. And at paragraph 4, if I read that out, it talks about it not being the first time that these concerns have been raised with management about bullying. I have consistently raised my concerns in letter, email, and on Facebook. To date, nothing has been done. Morale is at rock bottom. First things first, full points for spelling morale correctly. The number of times that members receive letters claiming the moral is at rock bottom needs to be seen to be believed. But in paragraph 4, there's an assertion that very significant issues have been raised before, but without action by the health service.
Mm. But this is the first letter to go to People and Culture, so.
That's exactly the issue. So it would raise the question of, well, if it has been raised before, where has it been raised? And clearly it may not have been raised through the appropriate channel, or there may be some element of exaggeration with regards to that claim.
Mm.
If we go to paragraph 5, it refers to further evidence of bullying can be found in a recent allegation against a member, Addo and E. Carnes. The claim that Addo stole several items of furniture and a drink vending machine is clearly a fabrication and further evidence of bullying. The video footage supplied has obviously been doctored. Clearly, you do not understand the principles of natural justice. What's happening in that paragraph is that there's a discussion about a specific employee that wraps an issue into an overarching one, in this case, bullying.
Sounds pretty harsh.
It's a little bit challenging.
Mm.
So there's a reference there at the end of that paragraph to natural justice, which is also interesting. But what's most interesting about that reference is not just the fact that it refers to natural justice, but it's that statement, clearly you do not understand the principles of natural justice. So it's a personal criticism, mm-hmm. which is also another telltale sign in terms of the type of letter that you've received. And you'll also notice that the letter uses the word clearly on a number of occasions.
And that's significant in the use of the word clearly, how?
It is. As a general proposition, whenever you see the term clearly in a piece of correspondence, it probably isn't clear.
No.
That tends to be the case.
So, what about the next paragraph?
I mean, so if we move to the next paragraph of that letter, it says, please advise why Addo and E. Carnes is being treated differently compared to Gertie Cummings, who has done things far worse.
Not sure what Gertie Cummings has done, but I mean, what does that even indicate?
You'll have to go and watch the musical Oklahoma to understand what Gertie Cummings has done. In terms of what that indicates and what that is, it's a question to which there is no reasonable answer. And that's a technique you'll often find in correspondences sent to employers.
Right. So what's another example of that?
Questions to which there's no reasonable answer. Other examples might include, can you confirm your intention to breach the agreement? Or questions that are based on a premise or an assumption that is disputed between the parties.
Hmm.
If we move through the letter and paragraphs 6 and 7, you'll note that there is a claim of unequal treatment and then the introduction of another compliance issue.
Which is then followed by a request to delay a meeting for about 6 months.
Yeah, look, that paragraph is really interesting. So you'll note while there are a lot of very broad general claims, there's a specific matter and the general and specific are being intertwined with an apparent intention to delay the process.
Strange. So then how does the letter conclude?
That's another interesting telltale point. It has a very short time frame for response, in this case a single day.
So I suppose, how would you characterize a letter like this?
So let's go through what our key indicators are. We've got an impersonal mode of address. We've got serious and broad-ranging claims without specificity. We've got personal criticism, a question to which there can be no reasonable answer. The mixing of the general, in this case general claims of bullying and agreement non-compliance, with the specific, namely allegations regarding a specific employee, a foreshadowed refusal to engage in process, as well as an unrealistic time frame for response. I think it's fair to describe that as a difficult letter or a stinker.
So I suppose the next question would be, are there any other features that members should be on the lookout for?
There are thousands of different variations for those kinds of letters, but the ones that stand out for me are those letters that take 2 pages of content and squeeze them into about 8 pages, those that demand that you produce cases to support your position, and those that extract large slabs of legislation and put them in the correspondence to you.
And they're all telltale signs of, I suppose, what we would call a stinker.
They are.
So then, given the hostility, wouldn't it be easier to just ignore the letter?
So what members will be very aware of is that if you fail to respond to a letter like this, the failure to respond will become the issue itself.
Right.
Because what we see in that letter is that there is a degree of escalation occurring, and it's necessary to manage that issue. People in, who are in people and culture departments have to deal with these kinds of letters all the time, and they're aware that there is a risk here that needs to be actively managed.
Right. So I suppose then, how should a member respond, and should they really, I suppose, give as good as they get?
So that's the key thing to avoid. Don't respond in kind. These letters are intended to be provocative. That's the way they're written. They're intended to provoke a reaction. And it may well be that the person who is writing the letter is seeking to get evidence from the employer that they are as unreasonable as the union asserts that they are. And a letter that responds in kind would be evidence that they are unreasonable. So it's important to take a different approach when responding to a letter of that kind. The key thing that an employer should do, or a person in people and culture should do, is write a response with a firm idea of their audience.
What do you mean by audience, and who would you consider to be that audience, I guess?
So audience in the context of writing a letter is, who is it that you're writing for? And in the context of something that may be a dispute at some point in time, it's not just the person who sent you the letter. You're thinking about who is likely to read that letter and how will they understand your point of view when they read it. So given that we have claims of bullying, we have claims of non-compliance, we have a possible disciplinary process, there's lots of reasons why a dispute could arise. And if those things can't be resolved, it's going to find its way to the Fair Work Commission. So in this instance, the Fair Work Commission is an audience for your response.
Right. So then in practical terms, I suppose, from my perspective or from the member's perspective, how does that affect my response?
Very simply, in the first instance, it's the choice of tone. People should use a respectful tone when they engage, even if the letter that they've received is quite obnoxious. It's not about going tit for tat in terms of insults. You shouldn't have any anger on the page.
Don't write with anger.
Don't write angry, as a rule. And second, what the letter should do is tell the whole of the story, and not just a fragmented version of the story.
All right, so why is telling the whole story important?
So if the matter does become a dispute, and if it does elevate to the commission, what you want your letter to do is be to tell the whole story. So if the commission was to pick up your letter, the commission would understand what the issues are, understand what the position of the health service is, and why. And that would all be there on the page, so that a person who knows nothing can understand all the issues from your letter.
That makes a lot of sense. Is there anything else, I suppose, that I should be thinking about, or we should be thinking about?
Absolutely. When drafting a letter, impose order. You'll notice that the letter we're responding to has a certain stream of conscious feel about it. The person has written the things really as they've occurred to them, as they've jumped into their mind and then written them down on the page. A response shouldn't do that. What it should seek to do is impose an order to make it easier to follow.
So I suppose, well, how would we go about that? How can we impose order in our response?
What we do is we bundle items together. Also, subheadings are a really effective technique for imposing order. So if you find the letter that you've received to be confusing, it's going to seem confusing to a third-party audience like the Commission as well. Mm-hmm. It helps everyone if the issues are sorted and if order is imposed on the dispute.
Okay. So I suppose with respect to this letter, how would we impose order here?
So let's use a couple of subheadings. We've got an alleged breach of Clause 32 and the non-payment of overtime, and we've also got issues in terms of the allegations against a certain person.
Right. I mean, that seems all right. Is that it?
There may be some additional issues that we want to that we also want to raise, and we might have next steps as an additional subheading where we talk about how we're going to interact with the dispute settling procedure.
So what would we write under next steps then?
I think that's the bit where we connect about how we are going to proceed and what is the pathway through that.
So take me through our response.
So earlier, Yumbin, we put up the draft or the letter that we'd received. So what's going to appear on screen is the letter that we're drafting in response. Mm. And the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to catch them off guard by utilising their first name rather than calling them sir or madam.
Oh, I mean, is that always appropriate?
Unless you're writing to the commission or a court or somebody who has an official function, then I would say absolutely.
What's after that?
We're going to say thank you. It's a very small thing, but it goes directly to the issue of tone. Mm. And it also gives us a chance to list the history of the correspondences between the parties. So in this instance, we're going to say, thank you for your letter of insert date.
And then what comes after that?
So it's at this point that we're going to start to impose some order, and we might announce what the structure of our response will be. So here we've said, in your letter, you've raised concerns, matters concerning a number of matters. Those matters are then listed, that is the alleged breach of Clause 32 concerning non-payment of overtime and concerns regarding a meeting to respond to allegations against your member, including a failure to comply with Clause 12. We shall address each in turn. We've identified the categories, we're telling them which order, how we're going to respond. Mm-hmm. We've imposed order.
Right, so then that takes us to our first subheading.
Yeah, it does. So in terms of our next paragraph, we've got a serious allegation of systematic non-compliance, but very little information to follow up on. In this instance, we might respond along the lines of, in your letter, you refer to a failure to pay overtime in accordance with Clause 32 over January, February and March. Further, you assert that when employees asked whether overtime should be recorded on their timesheets, that they were, in effect, actively discouraged from doing so.
So we've really restated the concern.
That's right. And after that restatement, we might outline our general position by way of a response. And that might go along the lines of, we expect timesheets are an accurate reflection of the time worked.
Okay. And then, I suppose, what happens next?
So the issue that we have with the letter from the union in this instance is not enough information. So that's what we need. We need more information, and there's nothing wrong with asking for that. So rather than simply criticising them for failing to supply the information, we're asking them to supply it.
Okay.
So that might be along the lines of, in your letter, you've not identified either the specific work area, the staff affected, or the members of management who it is alleged told staff not to enter the time worked. We ask that you provide that information at your earliest convenience.
Right. So we've talked about the the concern about overtime, but there's still the point about bullying in this letter.
Yeah, look, it's an interesting one. So it's something that must be addressed. Bullying is an extremely serious issue. The term bullying, however, can sometimes be used a little bit indiscriminately. And the challenge for people and culture is to test that so that they can figure out which category it falls into.
Right. And I suppose, how would they go about doing that?
So in the response, we might say something along the lines of, you also refer to bullying and that you have previously raised those concerns. We do not have a record of such concerns having previously been raised by you. We treat all matters regarding bullying seriously and encourage early reporting. If you have a complaint to make, we ask that you submit it. Please find attached a copy of our organisation's bullying policy and procedure.
So we're really inviting or encouraging them to make a complaint?
Absolutely. If there is an issue that needs to be addressed, it needs to be flushed out in order to give people and culture an opportunity to do that. Ignoring claims of bullying can be fatal to an organisation, so those concerns must be tested by obtaining details of the complaint and then ensuring that those complaints are handled in accordance with the policy and procedure of the organisation.
Right, that's very, very useful. Does that then bring us to our next subheading?
Yeah, it does. So in terms of dealing with this part, there's an allegation of serious misconduct, and I'd tie it at that point back to the requirements of the agreement in terms of dealing with an allegation. We've also got to address the assertion of inconsistent conduct on the part of the organisation between employees, particularly if that claim is presumably without foundation.
All right, so that's the unreasonable response. How do we respond to something like that?
It might go something along the lines of, you refer to the allegations of serious misconduct regarding Adoni Khan's. In accordance with Clause 12, I confirm that we have provided the material that forms the basis of the allegation as required by the agreement. You also state that you are unable to attend a meeting for approximately 6 months. This is not acceptable. Your member is entitled to have a representative present during the disciplinary procedure. However, to delay that procedure for that period would result in a significant unfairness to your member.
Why are we referring to the unfairness, I suppose, for their member?
That's an issue that tends to get forgotten or overlooked. Sometimes when there are correspondences between two parties or two representatives, the parties become so embedded in the dispute that no one's keeping an eye on the fundamental fairness issues to the employee. It is unfair to impose an unreasonable delay on an employee and to leave an issue unresolved for that period of time. So I would then add something along the lines of, a meeting has been set for a particular time. If you cannot attend at that time, to contact them directly and arrange a mutually convenient time, and if a mutually convenient time cannot be identified, we will consider whether to proceed to make a decision based on the evidence to hand.
So really we're telling the representative that the proposed delay is not agreed to, we're prompting engagement so that there's a pathway to settle the issue, and then we're really making it clear that the organization won't wait. But my concern then is, wouldn't that eventually result in a dispute?
It may well. And it may well be that if the parties can't arrange a meeting, then the commission is a very good place for it to go in order to break that deadlock and ensure that there isn't that unreasonable, unfair delay impacting on the employee. Just to emphasise that when people are asked to reschedule, generally speaking, those requests should be accommodated so long as the delay is not unreasonable. A person who asks to delay a meeting from Thursday to the following Monday, that is not unreasonable, generally speaking. A person who asks to delay by 6 months, and if that sounds like a ridiculous example, I can think of one specific instance where such a request was made to delay a disciplinary meeting for 6 months because of the alleged availability of the representative, then that would be unreasonable.
All right. Wow, that's a lot to take in, but is there anything else that I should be thinking about?
Yeah, look, we've still got that issue of uneven treatment to address. So for that, we might say something along the lines of, you refer to other employees of our organisation. We are committed to ensuring fairness to your member and to all employees of our organisation. We do not accept that we have acted in an inconsistent manner.
So we've rejected that assertion?
Correct. And the reason that we reject assertions that we disagree with is so that they don't remain undisputed. So when you're reading and assessing a letter from a representative, you're looking for assertions that need an answer. And that answer might be to agree, to disagree, to correct in part or in whole, but we're ensuring that it doesn't remain unanswered.
Okay. So I suppose after all of that, is it time to consider next steps?
Yeah, look, it is. So employers are entitled to utilise the dispute settlement procedure. So dispute settlement procedures are not something that are simply done to an employer. So if things are stuck, then we should utilise the dispute settlement procedures to keep them moving forward.
How might that go?
So under our heading of next steps that we talked about before, we might say something along the lines of, I acknowledge that there is a dispute for the purposes of Clause 10. Accordingly, we are required to meet. That's a really interesting point in that what's driving the dispute is a refusal to engage. If a dispute arises, there is an obligation to engage, either at the workplace or ultimately at the commission. Further, both parties are obligated to make a genuine effort to resolve the dispute. Those words appear in all our agreements. A meeting has been set for insert date. If you wish to reschedule, please contact me. And in the event that the dispute cannot be resolved, it is our view that it would be in the interests of all parties to seek assistance from the Fair Work Commission at the earliest opportunity.
Whew. So now we send our letter.
Not so fast. Now that we've got all that content there on the page, we've still got to edit it. Editing is a key part of the process. We talked about the fact that don't write angry, making sure there's no anger on the page, but we should also edit it in order to get the letter as clear as we possibly can. I think people sometimes make a form of view that they can simply write and then it will be fine as it is. Editing is a really key part of the process. So this book that we referred to here before, The Elements of Style, is a writing book. Most commonly, there's a silver cover that people might be familiar with rather than this dog-friendly one. But it's all about how to edit and how to write for work. And it involves removing unnecessary words. Before you send the letter, go back over it, remove all the words that don't need to be there to make the letter as clear and as concise as possible. And that will be to the assistance of a third party that ends up reading that letter.
Okay. I suppose that goes to the point of clarity and assisting the third party audience.
Absolutely. So we're always trying to get to the point of clarity with our correspondences.
Okay. What about the term, and I've heard this every now and then, without prejudice?
Yeah, look, that's one term that you'll see on correspondences from time to time. It tends to get misused. So sometimes you might receive a letter that is marked without prejudice.
What does that mean, really?
So what it means is that the content of that letter can't be used against the person who's sending it to you. So what it's trying to do is encourage a circumstance where the parties will put forward propositions to each other with the intention of resolving whatever dispute there is. And the only way that they can do that safely without prejudicing their interests is to say, well, this can't be used against me if I make you this offer.
So really, couldn't I put that on all of my correspondence?
You really shouldn't. You should only do it where you actually have a proposition to put where you need that. Sometimes we find that that disclaimer, I guess, appears on lots of correspondence. We've even had circumstances where we've received logs of claims from unions that are marked without prejudice. You either mean it or you don't. If you have an offer or proposition to put that you want to put on without prejudice basis, then use it. Alternatively, you may wish to use a term like without prejudice, save us to conciliation, so that the correspondence can be provided in that setting. But you should actively think about whether it's appropriate to use a term like without prejudice or not.
Okay, so I mean, if the letter contains an offer of settlement without prejudice, it's a mouthful, can be used.
That's correct. And that way it can't be used against you. That is, you must be acceding to our claim because you've been willing to make an offer. So it is to encourage people to try and resolve things between themselves.
Okay. So now we're ready to send our letter.
Now I think we are ready to send our letter. So that's our letter. Our letter is now ready to send. We get that back off to the union official. Two other quick things, though. One of which is... in terms of the time frame, and when you get a tight time frame like that, send a holding letter saying, look, we know that you want a response by this date, we will respond by an alternative date. You can shift the timelines, but it's helpful to manage that expectation. The second thing I would say is don't be afraid to pick up the phone, because people can get mired and bogged down in correspondence. It's useful to get out of that cycle to make a phone call. It could be a good way to test whether a dispute can be resolved. Eubin, thanks for going through that with me today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Stuart. A team of snow white horses in the slickest gig you ever see.